All right, so we will start now. That means to stop talking. All right, so let's be thankful that as hot as it is, it's not nearly as hot as it is in Iraq. Number one. And number two, the steaks we ate were not rotten meat as provided by Halliburton. So we've got that to be grateful for. So let me just start by hopefully people, if you can't see this picture I'm about to put up, try to locate yourself to do so. Can people all see this? Okay, so here we've got a painting by Rembrandt. It's one that LaRouche often references. Aristotle contemplating the bust of Homer. Let me just ask, who doesn't know who Homer is? A couple people. Who here has not ever read Homer? Okay, so a lot of people. People know his name, not really familiar with who he is. Right, yeah, not Homer Simpson. All right. Now, who knows who Aristotle is? All right, let me ask more. Who doesn't know who Aristotle is? Who's read Aristotle and is familiar with his philosophy? Or who hasn't read Aristotle and is not familiar with his philosophy? Okay. So here we've got a painting by Rembrandt with two figures, Homer and Aristotle. Knowing these two figures is absolutely essential to getting the idea which is intended to be communicated within this piece of work. So if you don't know who Homer is, or if you just know his name but really don't know his ideas or what is his place in history is, if you don't know Aristotle and you don't know his ideas and his place in history, you lose a tremendous amount of power that's trying to be communicated to you within this painting. Because in effect, what you've got is you've got Homer, who you've got the bookends of Greek civilization in a certain way. You've got Homer, whose ideas largely contributed to the initial rise of the Greek culture. And then Aristotle and the Aristotelian philosophy, which sort of echoed the collapse of Greece. And then you've got the ideas which are contained within their philosophy. You've got Homer, who has much more life to him, despite being merely a bust, a statue head. Whereas Aristotle has this very kind of cold, dead look on him. And so here you've got a certain kind of irony here. You've got a dead bust full of life, but yet you've got this living character, Aristotle, which is absolutely dead. So there's an idea which was intended to be communicated by Rembrandt in depicting these figures in this way. There's a certain idea about, okay, what does that tell us about perhaps what happened in Greece? Why it rose and why it fell? What does it tell us about our own thinking now? And what's the metaphor to be communicated about the quality of mind, the quality of idea that you find in Rembrandt versus Homer? But if you don't know who these figures are, you lose the power of that metaphor. At best, you might be able to look at it and get a sense of, well, it's beautiful to me. I don't know why, but there's something beautiful about it. I could say that. It's pretty. He seems to have had some skill in painting it. But and maybe if you really look close, you might get some sort of ambiguity, like, well, here's a statue head which seems to be much more alive than this guy standing there. But that's about as far as you could go with it. And this represents a real fundamental problem that we've got today and in today's culture, is that due to having been robbed of a real education, we've also been robbed of the power of receiving profound ideas from those who came before us, particularly artistic ideas, which often come through in the form of metaphor, irony. Now, this is at the center, and I'm going to develop this idea then through the domain of music and other sort of pedagogical devices. So, but this is central to the discovery that LaRouche made in economics. Because now you think about science. Take something like the moon model, right, that we learned about just moments ago. Now, I could walk up to anyone and say, guess what? I've got the moon model. And I could tell you, I just made a discovery. It's called the moon model. Do you know it? You could say, well, okay, yeah, I can call it the moon model also. And maybe we could hold up the figure of these nested cells and point to them like, that's the moon model. But really, what is that? Do we actually have the idea? How do we actually communicate that idea? How do I take an idea that exists in my mind and regenerate it, help to regenerate it within your mind, such that you not only can just point at something and say, and name it, but to where you have the idea, you know it as an idea. And so there's a method to that. Without that method, any discovery one might make as a scientist dies in the mind of that scientist. If one, they're unable to communicate it, if they don't have the power to communicate it, or two, if that audience to whom they're trying to communicate doesn't have the power of receiving those profound ideas. And so this is what's at the core of LaRouche's discovery, this correspondence between art and science and culture, and that economics is not separate from the two of those. It's the idea of ideas. Because that's the other thing you also lose in this painting. If you don't have the ability to get the metaphor here, you lose an even more profound ability, which is what LaRouche calls the communication of ideas about how you communicate ideas. Because say I know who Homer is, I know the ideas, I know Aristotle, I know the history. I can look at this and I get struck with an idea. I get an insight into the mind of Rembrandt and what he understood about the conflict of these two ideas in history. An idea about what happened in Greece. So now I have that idea that Rembrandt had in his mind. But then I can go even further. Because now I can look at this painting and say, how did he communicate that idea to me? And now I can actually start to look at not just that subject, that idea, but now I can start to get an idea about how that idea was communicated. But if we've lost the power to even receive the initial metaphor, the initial idea, we then lose the even greater power of discovering how to communicate profound ideas. And this is the essence of economics, of physical economy, which all starts with this unique characteristic, which is depicted also in this painting as well, which is really the subject of all art, of all classical art, which is this idea of what is the distinguishing characteristic of the human being from the animal. Right? That I could take this painting, and I tried it earlier when I was by the car. I showed it to the horse, and he didn't respond very well to it. It didn't do a whole lot for him. And I think even if I would have had a lifetime with that horse, it still would have done nothing for that horse. Because that horse is not cognitive. That horse cannot generate an idea beyond its sense impressions. It doesn't understand irony. It doesn't understand metaphor. So right now what we're going to do is just take a second. Mike's going to come up and he's going to sort of give you a picture, or start to give you an idea about what is this quality, what is this characteristic that we say separates man from the beast. So, Mike?
Okay, so I just wanted to give some form to the idea that Cody's talking about. There's a beautiful discovery that was made, going back, we don't know how far, to the geometers. It concerns something that you should be familiar with, something that you assume you already know very well, which is the circle.
I don't know if you can see that.
All right, so we take something that we We assume we know very well. I know a circle, right? You see these different shapes. You would never confuse yourself, would you? But unlike Aristotle, you know, we don't just look at something, name it, and say, aha, put it away, I got it, I own it. There's much more. Archimedes had done a series of investigations that concerned the circle and what's today called the quadrature of the circle, which means we're going to try to construct a polygon within, inside and outside of the circle to close in on it, on the circle's area. This part within the bounds of the circle, we want to know how much that would measure. So you can begin with the square or the triangle, and I'll begin with the square. We can show you later. It's a fun project, but you can figure out a way to evenly divide the circumference of the circle into four points along the perimeter. Now it's clear that from an inscribed circle and a circumscribed circle, I've got the circumscribed square on the outside and the inscribed square on the inside. It's clear from, you know, reason that we see that the area of the circle must lie somewhere between the two. So then through a method of, I guess, exhaustion, but you could evenly continue to divide the lines of the squares thus. And that would give you you could exactly double the number of sides of this polygon from 4 to 8, let's say. So, all right, yeah, maybe I should clear that up. You got a napkin?
Here.
Oh, can I do that? Do we have transparency? Okay, so I hope everyone can see this. This is an octagon. And I could do the same on the outside. I could create the octagon on the outside. So you see it, we're already closing in. We're already closing in on what we think is the area of the circle. But then something interesting arises, a beautiful discovery, which is something I hope all of you will work on and make a rediscovery, is that the closer, the more that I divide the sides of the polygon in order to get closer to the true perimeter of the circle, something interesting will happen. Let's take this. From my sense perception, it looks like a circle, the one on the right. What if I said that was actually a polygon that was 2 to the 256? It had thousands of sides, right? So it would have to inspect very closely. Right? If I had magnified the perimeter of this polygon, you would see several. You can't see it? Not perfect. All right, so let's assume that I'm zooming in on the this polygon. What I'm actually looking at let's say I've taken just even 1 minute or one fraction of a minute of this circle, I would still see several angles in there because there's thousands within the whole, right? So it appears that no matter how many times I divide this up, I'm never going to be able to make the straight and the curved coincide, right? I can carry this out infinitely, well, to a finite number, right? It's a gigantic number, and they'll never become reconciled. They'll always be different. So what the Greeks, like Archimedes, had discovered was that there was a species distinction between the straight and the curved, which is one of the keystones of one of the foundations of geometry, measuring the straight against the curved. But there's also a beautiful irony here, is that when we think of a circle, we think of by definition something that has, it's a shape that has no angles, right? It's or no sides, I should say. It's 360 degrees. There's no angles. There's no sides. It's just constant uniform curvature. It's a very unique shape in the universe, right? All circles would be the same form. So even though, as I keep infinitely expanding the number of sides and I grow ever closer to the perimeter, in species distinction, it's actually becoming less and less of a circle. You might even think that the square, having only four angles, was much closer to the circle than the polygon with 2 to the 256. So it's ironic, because to the senses, you know, you're filling up that space. And are you approximating the area? Yes, you are. You actually are increasing. You're coming ever closer to the true area of the circle. But at the same time, you're dealing with something that is clearly not a circle. Now this is just the jumping off point. This is a crucial breakthrough, which is picked up later by Nicholas of Cusa. He was the central figure of the 15th century Golden Renaissance. So he looked at this. He was going over the work of Archimedes, and he was able to make this rediscovery, but then also make a higher hypothesis about what was happening here with the circle. And he considered that this kind of investigation of the circle would actually, you know, you have to wonder, you know, what are we dealing with when we have a circle? What's generating the circle? And he had hypothesized something that we call the maximum minimum principle, which means that the circle is such a shape that it'll encompass the greatest amount of area with the least perimeter. Right? You would say that, you know, see in this inscribed circle, I mean the inscribed polygon, because it doesn't actually fill the circle, it doesn't have the same area. It has less of an area. If you go outside of the circle, you're going to have more of an area. So you can see, there's other ways of getting at this, but it's fairly simple to demonstrate that the circle would actually encompass the greatest area with the least perimeter. So he defined this as a maximum minimum principle, and there's angular relationships. But the key thing about that was that with this principle, he saw it as something that was outside of geometry. He wasn't saying, oh, you know, this is just another postulate, right? He was saying there's something acting in the universe, something outside of the circle, that's allowing me to understand this principle of minimum and this minimum maximum relationship. And he thought that it actually helped him discover that this was going on in many other things as well. So here you have an example of a higher hypothesis. You have this metaphor, basically, between this species distinction, this different kind of action or shape in the universe, which allowed him to hypothesize about other things that were going on in the universe, which were later validated. So this is a geometry, when you're looking at this stuff, the fun part about it is, you know, when you're doing geometrical problems and mathematics generally, you're actually learning more about how your own mind works. This is true science, you know. You're actually figuring out something that you didn't know before. It's not like the universe is doing anything different. But you had discovered something that you may have been wrong about or just totally unaware of. And you build upon it. That's the part that you would communicate, right? It's like we had to do some experiments today. You know, it's fun to pass on experiments, but it's not the experiment itself that is the science, right? It's kind of like the shadow of the science or the result. The part that you want to communicate is what you're not seeing. And this is a key example. When we use geometry, we use language. We're learning more about our own mind, and this is the nature of. It's a good way to get at man's relationship to the universe. And with Kuza, because he was a political organizer as well, he took this as a metaphor, where he had, because he was working with philosophical ideas and organizing the, you know, the Renaissance, organizing the churches, he thought this was an excellent example or metaphor of a relationship between our human mind and the Creator's mind. That as we increase our knowledge by this process of investigation and higher hypothesis, you may liken that to adding more sides to your polygon. So you can come to know more and more about the universe, although you won't have the universe itself in that way. Right? Does that make sense? You're coming closer to God's mind. You're coming closer to seeing things the way He sees it, or it sees it. And you share in that. That's your unique relationship to the universe. You get to do that. So that's what I wanted to present. And hopefully this will provoke kind of further investigation. We can lay down the joy of discovering and communicating ideas.
All right, so that represents a kind of, it should start to give you a sense of what is this quality that we distinguish as the nature of man. Right, if you look, it's from, say, Archimedes to Kuza, the ability to generate a higher hypothesis of understanding that the circle represents a higher species distinction from that of the straight line figure. And this is the character of the creative mind, the ability to take a set of ideas, push them to an extreme, find a paradox, right? The paradox is we can never actually approach the circle with the polygon. We then must, from that paradox, generate a higher hypothesis, generate an idea that, oh, okay, there is a species distinction. The circle represents an higher order principle in the universe. And it's that character which does define the nature or defines the history of mankind. That is the nature of man, the history of man. A process of superseding higher ideas, overturning old ideas, bring into existence, into the mind of man, greater ideas to increase the power of man to act in this universe. That's also the nature of the universe itself. If we take a look at, just briefly, take a look at something that's recently come up in some of the stuff on the moon model, some things LaRouche has talked about. If we just get an idea about the formation of our solar system, where LaRouche has talked about the sun starting off as a very fast-spinning hot ball of gas, which spun off spun off blobs of this hydrogen gas into these orbits, was then being hit with this pulsating energy, very high, dense energy pulses, created the kind of fusion process that O. Young was speaking of, generating the periodic table within the periodic table of elements on the planet Earth throughout the solar system. You have this process of development from hot spinning gas to orbits to differentiation of different types of elements in those orbits, in the planets. Then you look uniquely at one of the planets, Earth. Earth goes through this certain kind of evolutionary process moving towards greater states of order, right? From relatively homogeneous type of landscape, you know, all of a sudden you start to get an atmosphere, water forms, but you have a process, you've got relatively very shallow waters around the planet with pretty much smooth land. Out of different sort of transformations, you start to get a differentiation in ocean levels. Mountains start to arise. Climates start to take shape. You now have cold regions, very hot regions along the equator. All this stuff developed over time. That was not always the character of the earth. It didn't just sort of plop into existence, you know, as this Garden of Eden or something. Right? There was a process of development over time. Now, within that, then you think about what Kepler was looking at. Kepler started to, you know, first he had his initial hypothesis, which we spoke of earlier today, of the nesting of the Platonic solids. Right? He wanted to get an idea of what is the relationship of the various orbits, the known orbits of the planets within our solar system. And so his initial hypothesis that we could get an idea of the relationship of them as a nesting of these Platonic solids. Right, something to this effect. But where you would have inscribed and then circumscribed around these solids, spheres, which would represent the different orbits, and that the spacing of these orbits would be determined by the size of the Platonic solids. But out of that, there was a certain kind of paradox that then arose from that. We saw that there were certain discrepancies in his ability to forecast the future position or to even forecast the real orbit of Mars from that initial model. He then had to generate a higher hypothesis. He threw out his former model and generated a new higher one, which then put the orbits in elliptical shape as opposed to circular. Right, just a kind of an extreme example of it. Right, with the sun at one of the foci. Then he started to examine the certain kind of relationships amongst those elliptical orbits. And lo and behold, what did he find? He found that there was actually a harmonic relationship amongst these orbits. That the real relationship was not necessarily an ordering of Platonic solids, but it was determined by harmonic intervals, musical intervals. And so I can just give you a sense of one of them. This sort of interesting. He had a little joke on it, but he looked at the orbit of Earth and saw that in its path around the sun, from perihelion, the closest position to the sun, to aphelion, the furthest position from the sun, and back to aphelion, it went through the cycle of EFE, I think. Yeah, EFE, mi fa mi, and he made this little joke that this was characteristic of the Earth at that time, which was dominated by the 30 Years' War, mi fa mi, misery famine, misery and famine. That's what dominated the Earth. But he was sort of polemicizing against it because he wasn't actually nearly as cynical as most of us. But he also generated other relations. I can just just play maybe some of these intervals. And what he was looking at is the relationship of the two singular moments along the planet's orbit. Namely, it's perihelion, the point at which it's closest to the sun, where it's moving fastest, and it's aphelion, the position furthest away from the sun, where it was moving slowest. And he looked at the angular velocities at these two positions, and then looked at the relationship of those two positions, its fastest and slowest positions in its orbit. And like, for example, with Saturn, he saw a relationship of 4 to 5, which is a major third. You want to play a major third? Okay. Jupiter, he said, was a relationship of the minor third. Mars had a relationship of the fifth. Earth, EFE, was a half tone. Yeah, well, he was looking, it was like E. And then Venus, And then with Mercury, it was an octave. And so he had this idea that the solar system itself and this principle which he, this discovery he made of universal gravitation, actually was governed by a harmonic ordering of the planets. That there was a reflection of a composed intention within our solar system, which corresponded to that which we know as the musical intervals. And he even talked about the idea that the solar system would sing. And here's just a here's a quote from Kepler on this. This is from his book, Harmonies of the World. It says, thus, all these heavenly movements are none other than an eternally wonderful, many-voiced song, which transcends, only in thought, not recognizable from actual notes, discordance of tension. And then he went on. The infinity of the duration of the world within the short fraction of an hour, through an artfully structured musical work. He said, try to follow me, you musicians of today, and form for yourselves a judgment according to your rules of art, which were not yet known in antiquity. You have finally brought forth in the last centuries as the first law in which the universe is truly mirrored. Nature, that is ever abundant, after 2,000 years of brooding, through their many-voiced melodies, through the mediation of their ears, she, nature, has whispered to the human spirit, the favorite child of divine creator, her innermost being. And then he sort of had this little thing calling for the composer of the future to generate a, quote, artistically just motet. He says, whoever best expresses the heavenly music presented in my work, to him, Cleo, may give a wreath of flowers, and Urena pledge him Venus for a bride. So this was the idea Kepler, a scientist, had about the nature of our solar system. That it was, in fact, governed by harmonic relationships, reflecting a certain intention, a compositional intention by a composer. But then let's now take this further. Think about now back to Earth. What emerges then on this planet Earth? Through a certain development of various kind of plant species, superseded by high-order plant species, you know, the fruit-bearing plants, then moving into things like the what we get from, you know, largely domination by reptiles, to then we come into existence of the warm-blooded animals, the mammals, you know, requiring an ever-abundant vegetation, much more higher, greater metabolic rates. You know, so you start to see as O Yang went through, you start to see a development, an increased order, an increased diversification of species on the planet, and also an increase of energy throughput on the planet. It's actually developing, it's growing, it's evolving, but with a direction, with an intention, a non-arbitrary one. But then at some point, out of that, we find a unique biological organism, the human being, dominated by something of cognition. Now, what's the characteristic of this human being? This is what we actually want to get to within the music. That the human being, as we went through, our sole mode of survival is not through our genetic characteristic. Right? As Phil Rubinstein likes to often go through, you know, we as a biological animal are pretty damn pathetic. Right? Dull teeth, no claws, slow as hell. You know, even the hairiest of us are relatively non-hairy for colder weather. You know, we don't really possess any kind of real biological characteristics which enable us to survive, right, in this jungle. So what is it that it has enabled man, despite our biological flaws apparently, to move from, you know, a million or so species on the planet to over 6 billion? You know, there's a species distinction. There's something unique, this quality of cognition, this ability to move beyond our senses to discover universal principles, those principles embedded within our universe, discover them and apply them through the communication and assimilation of those ideas and apply them to increase the power of man to act in the universe, to increase the order on the planet. and ultimately increase the order in the solar system, which implicitly any action that we carry out on Earth does increase the order and the power of the solar system itself. But what is it about the biological apparatus that facilitates that character, that cognitive character? Because there is something unique about our physiology, which in effect, if you think about it, it's as if cognition had an intention to generate that carrier, to generate that biological apparatus that would be most transparent to the cognitive process, right? To generate that instrument that would be that would best facilitate the increased power of cognition, right? Cognition had the intention to increase its own power in the universe. But to do that, it had to create a biological organism that could best facilitate that. So now I want to start to look at is the character of that biological organism, and look at it from the standpoint of the instrument of the human body, which we get at in this as we start to look at questions of bel canto singing, beautiful singing. Now I'm not going to go through the whole, there's been pretty, you know, elaborate classes on the actual physiology behind the whole thing. But, you know, as people have seen who have tried to sing, right, it requires utilizing what we call the cavities of the body. Right, really you have to put the entire body into the process of singing. Right, you can never produce a beautiful sound just sort of half-ass, whatever, slouching. It's not going to work. There's a certain kind of dignity of character which one must maintain in order to produce that beautiful sound. Cognition demands dignity in order to generate. And so you have to actually utilize the entire biological apparatus to generate the beautiful sound required to transmit and communicate these profound ideas. Now, so what you have is, maybe I could bring, let me just bring Aaron and Ardina. And we'll start to look at, what we're going to start to look at is actually a quality of this singing voice, which is the register shifts. And let me just, let me put these up here.
It even works on that thing. You can see it on the back screen.
Can you?
Yeah.
I don't think it's big. It's too little back there. Can people see that? All right, so one thing we're going to look at is this, what we call registration, the principle of registration. Now what this requires is a change. As you move up, we're going to be looking at a soprano voice and a tenor voice. Where as you move up the scale, it's not just a linear progression of sound. It's not you're not just moving up with a higher tone as you go up. There's actually change in the quality of the sound, in the color of the sound as you move up, defined by very specific breaks, which we call register shifts. And it's outlined here by these different colors. First, second, third, and fourth register. Now, as you move up the scale and change registers, oh, can people hear me? As you move up the scale and change registers, what this requires is actually changing the location of the production of the sound. Because it's not simply a kind of scream. You're not just simply like, producing a sound straight from the vocal cords. You're taking air into your diaphragm, pushing it up through across the voice box, and then resonating that sound as you move up into, from the chest cavity up into the middle register, to the head register, and then the fourth register, you're more looking up into, kind of like up into this zone up here. But you're utilizing these various cavities. This is of the head. The mask, as it's often called. You're utilizing this mask to generate, to resonate the sound, and then project it in a laser-like quality. And actually, you might want to even look more into the physiology of how that occurs, but it is like how a laser is generated, where I use a pretty broad band of light, is then separated and then sort of put into phase. All light is then put into phase and put out as a coherent beam of light, a laser. And in the same way, that's what's happening, is being organized in these chambers, then projected as a laser, which is what enables an opera singer, a well-trained bel canto singer, to go into a giant opera house and fill the place up without any kind of amplification. Whereas you look at modern singers today, just like a little lounge bar or something, they need a whole wall of speakers just so you can hear them in a third row or something. But no, with bel canto, it's you're utilizing a different principle. You're utilizing a principle which is a naturally embedded character of the biological apparatus. That character itself being generated from the cognitive intention embedded within our universe. And so what we're going to use is, where are the singers? Aaron's going to go first. Okay, so we'll have Aaron's going to go first, demonstrating. And where are you going to go from, Aaron? From where to where? So you're going to go from here?
Yeah.
To where? You're going to go up into the third? No, don't do that. Go to like the whole range. Maybe you can just go from like the second to the third or something. How far? Okay, you want to maybe pause a little bit before you move into... You guys want to do a semi-pause before you then move to each register, just to...
Before each register.
Yeah.
Piano. What?
I want to be able to see what happens.
All right, so Aaron's going to start on a what? What's Aaron going to start on?
A.
Okay, so Aaron's going to start on the A and move up to what? Like the G or something, or... Yeah. So you can see the what? Oh. Oh, yeah, yeah. You see that? All right, so you're going to go from what? A to what? So where are you going to go from A to what? You're going to go from A to what? You don't know?
He's starting at E in the first
Okay,
register.
Okay.
And then we're going to do it, because it's a little bit difficult to go from register to register just on no.
Mm-hmm.
So he's going to do a specific exercise moving up through the second and third register.
You can't do it just moving up through the octave? That way you actually...
Yeah. Okay.
Just move up through the octave and... Just kind of pause as you go into the next register and try and listen for a different quality of sound as he moves up these registers. Okay.
No, 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 no.
All right, why don't you step out here a little bit and kind of project. Yeah, maybe Ardina, you want to do it? Okay, so Ardina is a soprano. You're going to go from what? From the C above middle C?
Yeah.
To where?
To the C.
To this C?
And then, wait.
Aren't you going from the middle C?
No, because I want to go through the second register shift from this C to this C. Because you can hear a more dramatic difference in the quality of sound that's produced there.
All right. You'll do like a little pause here?
Yeah, and I'll do a pause before the register shift so you can hear, hopefully you can hear outside of you.
Okay.
Let me try it. Okay. But I'll put my hand up when it's going to change. Oh, I'll pause. But, okay.
Could people hear a change?
Yeah.
Okay. You want to tell them, like, what's changing physiologically with you? Or, I mean, not physiologically with you, but...
No, but I guess, from what I understand, is when you're singing up in the higher registers, for the sopranos, for the tenors, too. Okay, it's when you're producing the sound in the higher registers for sopranos, well, for tenors probably too, but the mass that you're using to resonate the sound and to kind of the chamber that you're organizing the sound around before it's focused and ready to come out and be produced is more in your head registers and more in the lower registers in the second register and the first register. It's being more produced as a balance at times, and then more so in the chest register. But for sure, as you increase in the notes, as you go up the scale, as you get into the higher registers, it's more so being produced from the mask here in your nasal cavity in your face more so. That's the way I can explain it. But
do you want to try and do it without shifting?
Without shifting?
Not that high.
Yeah, that would be that'd be dangerous for my voice.
Okay. All right, Aaron, let's see what you got. You want to do it again and indicate where you're shifting?
At which point are you? No, I mean, I can hear, but just to tell people.
Yeah, no, I know. That's probably.
You don't know where you're.
C is where the shift is.
Okay, so that's what in the solfège? That's at the what?
C.
C, okay. So listen for at C in the solfège, that's where the shift is to occur.
Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, si, do.
Okay. So, all right. Fine. Huh? No, that's fine. I think people have the idea of a can Particularly, I think with the soprano, it's like just, I think by nature, it tends to be come out a little clearer. Okay. Okay, now let's do the shift from the second to the third. Yeah. Whenever he sang the C. Okay, so listen for a shift from do to fa. I think this will be going from the second to the third register.
It'll go first, and then in do, it'll go to second, and then,
okay.
Then on fa, it'll be, fa, right? Fa will be lesson.
Fa is in your second register.
So fa is the second one, and then the last do is going to be in the third.
Yeah.
The last note will be in the third register.
Okay. So listen to see if you hear a quality and change in color of sound as he moves from more emphasis of production of sound in the lower register as he moves up physically, generating the sound in the higher cavities of his body as he moves up the scale.
Do, re, mi, fa, so.
Okay. No, that's if you want to do it one more time. Huh? All right, why don't you try without shifting to see what happens? No? Okay. All right. Well, do people have to be honest? Could people, either an Aaron or an Ardina, hear a change at the indicated shift to a different quality of sound? Okay, I heard a no, but we'll go with popular opinion. Most people heard it. Well, we can talk after class. But, okay, so here's, now, in the whole domain of the human species, you're going to find that all human beings properly trained are going to fall within one of these six species of singing voices. And all children, male and female, up until the point that the men go through puberty and the women will tend to change a little bit, are all born sopranos. And what you find is that in a well-trained voice, there's a natural necessity to change the location of the production of the sound at these defined placings that we have here. For not to do that, which I guess we don't want to demonstrate to spare people damage to their voice. But to not do that, you would hear a very distinct falling off of power. Because as you go up, there is an increase in intensity and energy throughput occurring as you move up. But if you don't shift registers, you actually lose power. Right? So it'd be like moving from a circular wheel to a square wheel or something. Right? It becomes very inefficient to generate the sound as you move up without shifting. That's all right. Yeah. About what? Yeah, what I'm saying is that as you move up the scale as a singer, were you to not change the location where you produce the sound, then the quality of the sound would be diminished. You would actually lose power, right? You'd move up. You might start in the low register, and those low notes that belong in that register might sound fine. But as you go up, it would have a very dull sound, a very hollow sound. You'd be losing power. That's why I said it'd be like moving from like a circular wheel to a square one. So there's an embedded character to the human being that necessitates that shift at that defined location. Now, there's something more to this, because it's actually from... See, part of the idea of actually going through a lot of this is to start to give people an ability to start to even approach classical music. Because like we have with the Rembrandt painting, if you don't have the foundation to approach that classical work of art, you're not going to get the full idea. And in the same way with music, if you don't understand the principle of bel canto singing, if you don't know the principles of vocalization, if you don't know that all music is actually derived from the voice, and know that that was actually what was in the mind of people like Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, then you're going to lose a significant profundity of idea that you've got in these classical compositions. So part of the idea here is this to start to give people even the foundation from which to start to dive into and approach classical composition so that you can get the full power of the idea that these composers presented. Now, the thing is, there's actually an inverted process here. Because, right, what do we have? We have, right, we've got the musical scale here. We've got our notes all on here. And it's as if we are now defining the register shifts based on these notes that we've sort of placed on the screen here. But in fact, it goes the other way around. That the 12 notes that you find on the musical scale are defined by the singing voice. It's not the other way around. It's not that you first sort of took a string out and started dividing it, generated 12 tones, and then said, now let me impose these 12 tones on the singing voice. It's the other way. The universe came first, so to speak. So, and this is the idea. If you actually look at these singular regions, the register shifts, which define the actual boundary conditions of the singing voice. Right? This defines sort of the parameters of your singing voice are the register shifts. So if you just take a look, you can actually generate all 12 tones from the various register shifts. You know, you just start with, like you can locate any of them, all of them you can locate at the shifts. You know, the A, the B flat, the B, the C, C sharp, D, E flat, E, F, F sharp, G, G, G. All of them define the boundary conditions of the register shifts, which is something which is often lost. It's not usually discussed. Usually it's sort of, people look at it sort of in the reverse ordering, where you sort of impose the notes on the voice, as opposed to actually letting the voice and the natural register shifts of that voice define the notes themselves. And what this actually gives you is that you really don't need anything more than the 12 notes. Anything else, if you sort of divide it up, try to fit a note in between like B flat and B, it's not going to really do anything for you. It doesn't give you any greater power to compose music or convey an idea. It's very arbitrary. But these 12 notes, they're the only necessary notes that you must have, because they're the ones that define the boundary conditions of the singing of the human singing voice. Yeah? I don't know. Oh, he's asking how does that relate to the comma? Well, the comma, I guess, is just this paradox you run into as you start to divide the octave on a chord. Anna's the comma expert here. Maybe she could... You want to just briefly tell them what the paradox of the comma is?
Essentially, it's just what Cody was going through. You have, you can have, if you look at music in just in terms of a string of defined proportions, and this is something that the ancient Greeks used as an experiment, probably to demonstrate the primacy of the human voice, but if you take a string And they used a monochord, which is just an instrument which you pluck and it makes a certain sound. And depending on the ratios that you divide the string into, like if you were to cut off like one third of the string and then pluck the two thirds of it, you would generate what's called a fifth, right? And what happens is that's not how at a certain point that breaks down. Because, you know, in what you can look at is in a singing voice, a human voice, that you don't have. I mean, the question is, can you mechanize a voice? You know, how do you produce sound? Is a sound produced just by, you know, the exact physiological, you know, proportions, or is there something more ordering at the mind? So what you can do is, if you sing an octave, what ends up happening is that the actual relationships of the string break down. Like, if you were to do, I guess, divide up an octave an octave would be from like a C to a C. Can you play it? Okay. Now, if you can, there's different intervals within that octave. He went through what a major third was. If you divided up that octave into the major thirds, can you do that? All right. For each of those notes, you can generate certain frequencies based on the proportion of the amount of string that is being played, right? And so the question is, you know, with the comma, is how do you where does music come from? Is music just some sort of, you know, system that came from cutting up a straight line? Or is there, because there's a discrepancy between the line and then what the voice produces. And if you play around with the voice singing that interval and then generating the frequencies from cutting up the string or looking at the monochord, you know, you can play with it a little bit more. I don't know if that, is that clear? No? Okay. Yeah, okay. What happens is a frequency is the amount of vibrations per second of the string. So for, let's say you cut the string into half and you pluck one half of it. It's going to vibrate double the amount of the total string, right? So let's say the whole string has a vibration of 256 or 64. It vibrates 64 times per second. So if you cut the string in half, you know, according to the formula, it should vibrate 128 times per second. Okay. So if you go through and you work out, you know, what the frequency, if you were to take that relationship and then just go from, you know, through the octaves on a piano, or just from a C at 32 to a C at 248 or 1024, right? If you went through the whole like spectrum of the notes on the through octave wise, right, which would be just dividing up the string by halves, you would generate a frequency that doesn't correspond to where the human voice, that is not where the human voice will end up. So the question is, why? And so the discrepancy between that process and the human voice is the comma.
So, I mean, I guess the point would be that, I don't know, I guess that's not where music comes from. It doesn't actually come from the equal divisions or the... Yeah.
Vocal registration occurs, that actually determines...
Yeah, right. Where the voice changes, those shifts are going to determine those relationships that make up your 12-note scale.
But when you put it on that...
Mm-hmm. Well, because there is a discrepancy between the voice and the piano. Well, that's what's going to determine the increase in pitch, yeah, is length and thickness of string. Yeah, well, we can talk about that. I'm not quite sure what you're asking, to be honest. Yeah, it's a different question. Vibrato and the vibration of the string are different things. Yeah, but I mean, this is actually part of why, like in singing, polyphonic singing, you don't actually get the intensity of dissonance that you tend to find in the piano. Like, you'll tend to generate more dissonance in the piano. Part of the idea there is to actually communicate the differentiation between the voice and the piano itself. I mean, I think that's part of the idea that actually people like Bach are going through, and things like the well-tempered clavier, is that the fact that he's generating so much dissonance in these things is somewhat of a communication of the idea that there is a certain differentiation between just trying to play a piano, which is divided up according to sort of pure division, so to speak, and the human singing voice. But back to this idea. So, yeah, the point we want to get at is that there are certain relationships that are then generated here in terms of what you could look at as like frequency relationships as you move from one register to the next. Those frequency relationships are what we would how we would determine the relationships of a musical scale as you move up from C to C. But those relationships can all be generated as a function of the register shifts in the human singing voice. So the entire musical scale can be generated from simply the relationships that are produced by the register shifts, the natural register shifts of the human singing voice. Which gives this idea that this 12-note scale was already embedded within the universe itself prior to our discovery of it. That even these artistic discoveries themselves are not arbitrary. You know, in the same way that universal gravitation was already a principle acting in the universe prior to Kepler's discovery of it, in the same way you could say that the 12-note system was already a principle embedded in the universe prior to the discovery of it by man. But it's then through the discovery and the application of that discovery that we increase the power of man to act creatively in that universe. And so now there's even some of a higher order principle then also embedded in this, which is this idea of the Lydian principle, which is this idea of the halfway movement from, as you move from, you know, C to C, right? That which divides the octave in half. Maybe you can just play me while the C to C, then C, F sharp, C are together. Yeah. Right, you hear this dissonant quality there? Do people hear? Maybe play like more of a less dissonant octave, and then maybe the Lydian, kind of loud. I think it's... Yeah, it's kind of soft. People can't... Is there a way to turn it up? All right, do people hear the difference between the two? Now, if you look at this F sharp is what defines the change from the second to the third register in the soprano voice, which is unique in the fact that the soprano voice itself is the voice species that all human beings are born at, as we mentioned, prior to going through puberty and the changes in the voices. So there's something already also embedded within the voice of this quality of change, represented by the dissonance that you find in the Lydian interval. It's not that it's the dissonance which is so unique, is so key, but it's that the dissonance represents a change. Right? It's not that you just use dissonance as a means of just sort of agitating people. But it's like the dissonance you have in an idea. It's that sort of, it's that tension, that dissonance, which is foreshadowing the new hypothesis, the change. Which actually takes us back to, you know, something more of an elaboration of it, which is just to sort of take you back to Kepler and this idea that we found in the universe itself. Which is that you do have a register shift in the solar system. And this is something which Kepler himself had hypothesized, that though he never saw or had any empirical evidence of the asteroid belt, he hypothesized the existence of it based on a harmonic understanding, that there necessarily must exist something in this region, but that it would be a planet which he hypothesized was an exploded planet due to the fact that it exists in a somewhat inharmonious region along the solar system. And in fact, like you have the distinction between the two, like as you move from the second to the third register, or from the third to the fourth register, there's a different quality to the sound, a different color to it. You have the same thing amongst the planets themselves. The inner planets up to Mars all tend to be smaller, denser, rockier planets. Then you have the asteroid belt. Beyond the asteroid belt, from Jupiter on to, I guess, whatever, whenever Kepler was there, he only knew up to what, up to Saturn, you have much larger, gassier planets. There's a very distinct quality differentiation between the inner planets and the outer planets. The inner ones being smaller, denser, harder, rockier planets. The outer ones being much larger, giant, gassier planets. Divided by this region, this asteroid belt. Which, if we look at this chart here, actually, if you start to look at this thing as a process, as a projection of rotation along a cone. Here we've got a self-similar geometrical figure, the cone, where, you know, it increases geometrically as you move circularly around the cone. And then we project that spiral down onto a flat plane. Now, if you take as one rotation, if you move from the outer layer of the sun to Mercury, that takes you one full rotation around the spiral. And then from Mercury to the outer planet Pluto, it takes you through Neptune, it takes you, at least in this model, it takes you through another full rotation of the spiral. Cut in half by the F sharp. Right? Because you can put into correspondence. Can people see this diagram here? Right, put into correspondence with the 12-note cycle here. As you move around, halfway around corresponds to where you would, if you superimpose it on the 12 notes here, halfway around, which would be half a cycle around the cone, puts you at the F sharp, and then to complete it the other way around takes you to Neptune. Such that, in fact, it's divided by this. You want to play it again, Miwa? From the C to the F sharp to the C again? So you've got the inner planets divided by the F sharp region, this discordant, inharmonious region, the asteroid belt, and then the outer planets, the bigger, gassier planets. So in fact, also already embedded in our solar system is this principle of registration. Right, you have an actual register shift within the solar system itself. So now we'll just take a quick move here. Are we running out? Am I going too long here? All right. So now I just want to kind of change gears a little bit as we start to wrap this thing up, sort of. and start to actually now, okay, now how do we actually apply this principle? Okay, so now we have an idea. We're working with something which is universal, is a universal principle. Cognition having brought into existence this biological apparatus, the human singing voice, with this character of registration, register shifts, coloration, these six species of voice. Now, how does this then become get applied? Because that in and of itself isn't just going to like magically generate ideas. Just by having a piano in front of you and just playing a scale isn't really going to produce any profound ideas in people. So how actually then is this then taken and used in an efficient way to increase the power of cognition? And so to get a look at just at the character of this, we're first going to take a quick look at Plato. And just before we read the Plato, I just want to give you a sense of how LaRouche is looking at this in music, from a quote from an essay called Project A. Let me see here. Okay, so here's what he talks about with classical composition, which is what we're going to get into. He says, in the case of classical composition, in the case of counterpoint, not in the sense of schoolbook text, but strictly in the sense of principles, provided that this is based on the proper tuning, of course, there is a very elementary kind of illustration of the creative principle from the standpoint of the representation of in defense of common sense. For example, the simple singularities which occur as harmonic or rhythmic dissonances, not arbitrarily, but generated from the lawful elaboration. These dissonances have to be resolved. They are not resolved in order to reestablish the theme as subject of the composition. Rather, the resolution of the dissonances in the form... Rather, the resolution of the dissonances in this form, in well-tempered polyphony, is the subject of the composition. So he's talking about that in this process of musical development, there are going to arise through things like you have with the Lydian principle. You're going to generate certain dissonant relationships amongst the voices, generating a kind of singularity, like we have in the register shift. There's a singularity generated as a change, right? The singularity itself is not to be generated just simply to generate dissonance, but it's generated to provoke change, to indicate a principle of change. And this is the idea that it's actually that quality of change, the principle of change, the generation of paradox and the resolution of it through a method, really a Socratic method, which is the actual subject of the composition itself. It's not the theme, it's not the melody, it's not the sensual experience, but it's the communication of a method of generation of paradox, the principle of creative play, which is the subject of the composition. And so just to get sort of at this, to dig into this, Where's Danny? We're just going to do a little quick snippet from Plato's Gorgias. And just listen for this quality of, you know, you're dealing with two different personalities, Socrates and Gorgias, engage in a dialogue. And just sort of listen for this idea of the generation of certain kind of dissonances within their dialogue. Right, where Socrates will take a certain sort of theme, present a theme, you sort of get something thrown out then by Gorgias. Socrates then takes what he does and sort of takes it to its boundaries to generate some sort of paradox in his thinking. You know, comparable to what we want to be looking for as we start to approach classical composition. Okay. Gorgias, do tell us yourself in what art it is you are skilled, and hence what we ought to call you.
Rhetoric, Socrates.
So we are to call you a rhetorician?
Yes, and a good one, if you are pleased to call me what, to use Homer's phrase, I vaunt myself to be.
Well, I am pleased to do so.
Then call me such.
And are we to say that you are able to make others like yourself?
Yes, that is what I profess to do, not only here, but elsewhere also.
Then would you be willing, Gorgias, to continue this present way of discussion by alternate question and answer, and defer to some other time that lengthy style of speech in which Paulus made a beginning? Come, be true to your promise and consent to answer each question briefly.
There are some answers, Socrates, that necessitate a lengthy expression. However, I will try to be as brief as possible. For indeed it is one of my claims that no one could express the same thing in briefer terms than myself.
That is just what I want, Gorgias. Give me a display of this very skill in brevity of speech. Your lengthy style will do another time.
Well, I will do that, and you will admit that you never heard anyone speak more briefly.
Come then, since you claim to be skilled in rhetorical art and to be able to make anyone else a rhetorician, tell me with what particular thing rhetoric is concerned. As for example, weaving is concerned with the manufacture of clothes, is it not?
Yes.
And music, likewise, with the making of tunes?
Yes.
Upon my word, Gorgias, I do admire your answer. You make them as brief as they well can be.
Yes, Socrates, I consider myself a very fair hand at that.
You are right there. Come now, answer me in the same way about rhetoric. With what particular thing is its skill concerned?
With speech.
What kind of speech, Gorgias? Do you mean that which shows by what regimen sick people could get well?
No.
Then rhetoric is not concerned with all kinds of speech.
No, I say.
Yet it does make men able to speak.
Yes!
And to understand also the things about which they speak?
Of course.
Now, does the medical art, which we mentioned just now, make men able to understand and speak about the sick?
It must.
Hence, the medical art also, it seems, is concerned with speech.
Yes.
That is, speech about diseases?
Certainly.
Now, is gymnastics also concerned with speech about the good and bad condition of our bodies?
Quite so.
And moreover, it is the same, Gorgias, with all the other arts. Each of them is concerned with that kind of speech which deals with the subject matter of that particular art.
Apparently.
Then why, pray, do you not give the name rhetorical to those other arts when they are concerned with speech, if you call that rhetoric which has to do with speech? So hopefully people are able to get from that a sense of that kind of process, right? There's a certain kind of generation of paradox, a certain generation of dissonance through communication of voices. Because the other point to be emphasized, that communication of ideas takes place amongst human personalities, right? With voices that can sing. And so any time you're dealing with the communication of ideas, particularly any ideas that deal with vocalization, ultimately you're dealing with the principle of singing. Now, just to sort of emphasize that point even greater, Danny is going to utilize his skill in Greek to read through that very same section in two voices in classical Greek, which really is the essence of sung polyphony.
Μάλλον δε ο Γοργία αυτός αμήν επέτεινα κρακαλέν ως τίνος επιστέμα τέκνες.
Τες ρατορικές ο Ζόκρατες.
Ρατορα άρα κράωσε καλέν.
Αγατών γε ο Ζόκρατες, ε δε ο γε ευκόμα έδνε, ως επέχομερος μούλε με καλέν.
Αλλά μούλο μαϊ.
Καλέ δε.
Ο κούν καί άλλος επόμεν δυνατόν σωπόεν.
Επαγγέλλο μάιγε δε τάωτα ουμόνον τάδετ αλλά καί αλλότι.
Αρούν ετελάσεις. Ω Γοργία, ως περνούν διαλάγωπτμε. dia telesai tomer heroton. Toda chrominonimus. Tode mercoston logon tuto, oion kai pallos. Arxato esautis hepatestae alhoperi pist cur. Maps hausai alla etelese catabracuto erotomenon apocrinestae. Esimen ho Socrates, eniae ton apocriseon, anankaia dia macron tus logos poestae, un men alap herasom aegehos dia bracutatun. Caegar aucae tuto enesti non pami medena annen bracut herois emut auto vepen. Tuton mende, o Gorgia, cae moi epidexain autu tuton poesae tes braculogias macrologias de esautis. Alam poeso, cae udonos passes bracologo teru acusae. Pere da, rhetoricas, gar pais epistemon technesenae gar poestae, ancae allon rhetora, rhetorica peri ti ton auton tun canaeusa. Os per ha upantica, peri ten ton imation ergio annagar? Nae. Ucun cae ha musica periten ton melon poiesin? Nae. Nae ten herran, o Gorgia agamaetetas apocrises. Oti apocrone os oion te diabar crotutaton. Panu gar, hoi mai, ho Socrates epecos tuto poen? Eu leges. Iti demoi apocrinae huto cae perites rhetorices. Periti ton honton est in epistemen. Peri logus. Poius tutos, o Gorgia, ara oia, delusae tus cantomos, o sandiat homon hugiainonen. Ucara e peri pantos ge tus logus e rhetorica est in? Data. Alla men legen ge poedunatus. Nae. Ucun peri hon per legen cae pronen. Oscar u. Arun, en nun de legomen, e hitarca peri ton, cam non ton poedunatus, enae pronen cae legen. Annanca. Cae haiat rica hara, ose oice peri logus est in? Nae. Tusce perita nos amata. Malista. Ucun cae ha gunnastica peri logus est si tus peri euxian tetons omaton cae caxesian. Panuge. Cae men cae hae halae tecnae, o Gorgia utos ecusain ecasta, autun peri logus estit utus, oitum canusain ontos periton pragma hu ecasta estin tecna. Painetai. Tiunde potetas alas tecna suproptit, rhetoricas cales, usas peri logus, e per tautan rhetorican cales, annae peri logus.
right, so now that you got a clearer idea of what it is that we are to be, of how we're supposed to start approaching principles of musical composition, we now want to actually look at a quick, this is actually just going to be a snippet from Beethoven. Is this plugged in over there?
Do I need to do this?
All right, so sticking within the same principle of dialogue, but now moving from, instead of Greek, we're now going to be looking at the pure language of music itself. We're going to take a look at just a quick snippet from Beethoven's Opus 135. And what I want people to look for is actually this dialectical process, where though you're dealing with instruments, four-stringed instruments, you are dealing with four unique personalities. And if you look at it, you actually have the same kind of quality, where there's a certain kind of theme taken up, there's a certain kind of agreement amongst the instruments that take up this theme, and then a dialogue ensues. We've got four different personalities, each defined by their own set of, you can assume different set of kind of axioms or hypotheses, and you actually see how these different personalities interact. And so just sort of have that in mind of this dialogue as you hear this, this quick thing. Number six. What's the volume number? So could people get a sense of that kind of dialogue going on there between the various personalities? You actually do hear certain kind of questions being posed, responses, agreement on certain themes, and in certain convergences and divergences. So this is actually the principle of real classical composition. It must always be approached from the standpoint of different voices and personalities in a process of communication. Now, this really is the last part of it. So it's going to look at a series of different examples of how this was actually the understanding that people like Bach, Mozart, Beethoven had about classical composition. So it's going to put up for...
Give those two-part inventions. No, that's all right. I'll actually show just some overheads here.
Yeah.
not the clearest, but these are from the original manuscripts of Bach's two-part inventions, which are written for the piano. But if you actually look at the way that they're staffed, the way they're scored on the staff, he actually uses these particular kind of staffing here, which is kind of looks sort of like a very fancy K, I guess the best way I could describe it. What's the actual, do you even know what the technical name for that? Well, the way it's set up is that the hook actually occurs where you want the middle C to be for that particular voice. And so I think this one corresponds to where you would do it for a soprano voice. But you can see it's not using your typical treble and bass clef. It's actually using, you know, here you've got it where it's marked for the middle C to be here. Here it's got the middle C, I think, marked here, which is usually where it's marked for, I think, usually the alto voice. So I'm not sure. So, I mean, the idea is he's actually looking at this from the standpoint of voicing. Even though it's written for the piano, he actually scores it, staffs it, as if he was writing it for the voice. And in fact, he actually says exactly that. Here's just a little introduction that he wrote to these two-part inventions, where he says, "Sincere instruction, wherewithin amateurs of the clavier, in particular the ones avid to study, are shown a distinct manner, not only one, to learn how to play clean with two voices, but also in the course of further progress, two, to deal correctly and nicely with three obbligato parts. At the same time, not only get good inventions of their own, but also to develop them well. Mostly, however, to achieve a singing manner of playing, and along with it, to receive a strong foretaste of composition." Made by Johann Sebastian Bach, and this is 1723. So he himself actually indicated exactly what was in his mind, that these were written from the standpoint of getting a sense of vocalization, of voicing. So now, what we'll look at, and just to show you, this is from the Kyrie by Beethoven, where if you look at the way he scores the vocal parts, he used the same kind of staffing, where he uses, I guess it might be even called a C clef, where for the different voices you place this according to where you want the middle C to be. You know, and this is at the time where they started to, or even maybe just this addition, they moved to things like the treble and bass clef for the instrumentation. But this is what they use for the voicing. But that's what Bach was actually using for his two-part inventions, for the something written exclusively for the piano. Now we're going to look at, if you go to, the Musical Offering by Bach. Is that it?
Yeah.
Oh, here we go. What he does is... Oh, damn. Okay. What he does is, after establishing the theme, he then actually takes you through a whole series of register shifts. And if you actually look at the ones he does, he takes you through the entire set of register shifts from the first to the second register, from the FF sharp. He goes through a series of half steps through the FF sharp, E flat E, C sharp D, B, C, A, and G. He leaves out the B flat and the A, but it was already introduced into it, so it's sort of already implied in your memory. But the series of half steps he takes you through are exactly the half steps that correspond between the shifts from the first to second register and all six singing voices. And then, after taking you through that, he then takes you to He then sets you up with like the principal, I guess, generator of classical composition, the C, C octave, and then the F sharp. So right away he throws you right into this idea of the Lydian interval. The C, C octave divided by the F sharp, which actually takes you through the top... takes you through the top two register shifts of the soprano voice. Which then also indicates, too, the fact that he's taking you through those register shifts, that that particular section of it is written as a soprano voice, which then he then comes right in after sort of throwing that in, after laying that foundation there, the half steps through all the register shifts, first the second register of all the six singing voices, then establishing the sort of the heart of bel canto singing, the register shift of the soprano voice, the universal voice. He then brings in a second voice. So we're just going to hear a quick, just a part of this. I'm not going to play the whole thing from Miwa Steger. So after Bach, taking up the same theme, but more than even the theme, we're looking at just this Lydian principle, this dissonant principle, which, as we said, is not to be seen just as dissonance, but is to be seen as a reflection. It's almost a shadow of change. It's a shadow to reflect the principle of a transformation, right? Like we saw in the solar system, that's how the Lydians use it. It's used as a shadow to indicate a principle of transformation, of successive higher hypotheses of the human mind. So here we're going to look at now the fantasy of Mozart, where building off of Bach takes the Lydian principle then to an even new extreme. Whereas Bach, he used it, but he used it sparingly. He often took much more time to sort of develop the idea of the introduction of the Lydian. With Mozart, it becomes much more of an explicit aspect of his work. And so we're going to hear a... What's that? Yeah, we're going to hear a little snippet of this fantasy. And you actually hear a bit of the same theme that we just heard. But just listen for it. Maybe Miwa will say something about some of the Lydians in this, but it's... The density of it becomes much, much more.
Okay. Now, once you then move to Beethoven, it just becomes even more, because he's actually given more power by the shoulders of Bach and Mozart, particularly with the use of this Lydian principle. I mean, it's much like we talk about in science, this idea of the necessary predecessor and necessary successor in scientific discoveries. That in order for Beethoven to do what he does, where he just takes this idea of the Lydian principle, the foundation of the human singing voice, and he just thrusts you right into change, the principle of change, unlike the previous before him. But it was the necessary developments that had put there by Bach and then Mozart, which gave him the ability, which allowed him to do that in a way which was lawful. So here we're just going to look at, this is from, we're just going to look at another snippet from the Opus 111 from Beethoven. Which is dense with these Lydians, right? Right from the jump. Just to actually conclude this section, we're going to go back to there from whence this idea of bel canto came, and we're going to hear an Italian aria from Aaron Halevi. But hopefully, I mean, if people just think back to this idea initially, the whole intention is to give people the basis to start actually looking into these classical pieces so that we can avoid the kind of problem we had here. And just to show you real quick, this is actually a picture from the notebooks. People can see this. These are from the notebooks of Kepler, where he actually shows the different planets traveling through their various interval relationships. So, this is Aaron singing what?
This is Virgin Tutu Amor, which is meaning the Virgin Mary, full of love. Mm.
Okay. All right. So it's probably better that I go late at night anyway, because I have a story to tell that should only be told in the woods late at night, surrounded by friends and loved ones. And it starts out with a question, which is, why is the first time a lot of you are hearing about this at LaRouche's presidential campaign? Why wasn't what Cody went through seems to be somewhat primary? It seems to be something that you would want, if you were actually interested in developing citizens who could think in a certain way or could reflect beauty, it seems that naturally you would want to start this process in kindergarten or before. You know? So, you know, Cody brought up this idea about communicating ideas. He said, you need two variables to be fulfilled. One is you actually have to have the capacity to communicate the idea. You have to know what you're talking about. The second one is you have to have an audience that can actually receive the idea and understand it. And the tale I'm going to go through tonight is how our population, the United States, was basically that capacity was perverted. That our capacity to understand ideas, to understand beauty, was intentionally attacked. And specifically, I'm going to go through this guy, Theodore Adorno, and his role in this. We have this Children of Satan pamphlet that's been out. I'm sure a lot of you guys have read it. But the reason I thought it would be good to do this, a bunch of us did, was because it's really important to actually to get a real sense of how these people thought, what their method was for basically transcribing the emotions of human beings from that of something real to something that they term as a fetish. So that, you know, and as I go through it, you'll kind of see what I'm talking about. But I'll try to be, it'll be a good challenge in composition. Okay. So it's been brought up a lot this weekend also, this question of developing a truthful culture and, you know, that what we have right now is sophistry. You know, Lynn said this morning that throughout the 40s, 50s, and 60s, what you had was a population that became a bunch of sophists. You know, they had no care for what truth was. Right, it became basically, essentially, opinion. We're not going to measure our ideas against the universe and see if they're right. We don't care about that. The only thing that we care about is how many people agree with our idea. And that's because of what Adorno and these guys did. Let me just start right out with it. This is from his paper on the fetish character in music and the regression of listening. Okay. He says, and, you know, one thing before I start, which I think it's appropriate, is I found when reading these people that they're very seductive. they couch what they're saying in, I guess, what is just extreme academia. You know, they don't actually come out and say, well, my intention is to write here, you know, the manifesto to create a population that will go insane, or to create a population that will not oppose fascism, or to depopulate the world, right? The way that they kind of couch it in terms of, oh, well, I'm going to kind of give my criticism of what's wrong. I'm going to present all of the problems in society, right? And so you can get, I got a real sense of what happens when someone stays, if someone were to stay in school and really just adopt adopt a real love or a real respect for these professors who say, oh, well, what if hypothetically, we had free trade? What if we had free trade to the fullest extent? What if everybody, what if these countries like producing coffee and bananas or something like that? Or what if, these cultures they like to die at 25? That, discussions that have an intention, but it's just very shrouded, So I just wanted to throw that out there as a warning if you're going to read these people. So he says, okay. Art records negatively just that possibility of happiness, which the only partially positive anticipation of happiness ruinously confronts today. If you don't understand it, it's okay. I think it's incomprehensible. But we'll just go through like bits and pieces of it, because some of it is very clear where he's going. He says, all light and pleasant art has become illusory and mendacious. What makes its appearance aesthetically in the pleasure categories can no longer give pleasure. And the promise of pleasure, once the definition of art, can no longer be found except where the mask has been torn from the countenance of false happiness. He says, if the new phase of the musical consciousness of the masses is defined by displeasure in pleasure. So you're going to take people who get pleasure from certain things, and you're going to take those emotions that they attach to certain pleasurable things and attach them to something that would normally give them displeasure. Maybe like tattooing or piercings or, something that would give you pain. Right? But you want to do it. If nothing else, Schoenberg's music resembles popular songs in refusing to be enjoyed. Whoever still delights in the beautiful passages of a Schubert quartet, or even in the provocatively healthy fare of a Handel Concerto Grosso, ranks as a would-be guardian of a culture among the butterfly collectors. So right off the bat, he maybe a little background is required. But Adorno was born in the early 1900s. He studied under Schoenberg and this guy Alban Berg, I think in Vienna, in the early 1920s. He was trained as a concert pianist. So he's very technically proficient. He went to learn from Schoenberg and these guys. And Schoenberg is the guy who created, the composer who created the 12-tone system, which is, I guess you could call it the people's music, because in the 12-tone system, as opposed to what Cody was going through, where you actually have, depending on the idea that you want to get across, you create different relationships between notes, right, to form that idea in the mind of the audience. In the 12-tone system, it's very fair. No note. There's 12 notes, first of all. No note is any more important than any other note. Each note is in equal relationship to the note that comes before it and after it. And, just so there's no foul play, once you've played one note, you have to play all the rest of the notes before you can come back to that note. Yes. Is that it? Is that how they teach it? Yeah. Okay. So it has nothing to do with the human voice. If anything, that in itself is a little bit neurotic. Right. So Adorno, he goes and studies with Schoenberg. These guys are part of an operation that's called the Frankfurt School, which we go through in the pamphlet. And their intention is to create, their specific intention is they wanted to create a social revolution. They wanted a socialist revolution. And they were excited because in 1917, they had gotten one in Russia. They had overthrown, in Russia it had become a socialist communist state. And in Eastern Europe, they were overthrowing all these governments. And the thing is, and whoever funded them, you know, and whoever promoted them, their intention was to create those revolutions in the West, in Western Europe and the United States. And they ran into a problem, which was it didn't work. That there was a different quality to the labor inside Western Europe and the United States that didn't want to become a cog in the wheel, essentially. And they identified this as the individualism, the identity of being an individual. I mean, think about citizenry in the United States. You know, think about the labor that we, the labor, you know, tradition that we had in the 19th century, where people, or even the early 20th century, where you would have, you know, people producing things, and they would go to work, and an individual would or could introduce a new idea into the labor, whether to improve the product, whether to just make it easier to produce the product more efficient. So, you know, think about the kind of person who wants to do that. Think about today. You know, how many people today give a damn about what they do? How many people actually want to improve the work that they do? People's relationship to work today is completely different than it was 100 years ago. And these, you know, it reflects a certain culture also. Because if you're not going to have the ability to make a discovery, or you're not going to want to, really, there's going to be no motivation to do it, unless there's actually a culture that says, if you want to make a change, if you want to improve something, we'll do that. If you want to introduce a new technology, if you want to introduce a new idea, we as a culture think that's good. We promote that. You know, if you have a good idea, we'll introduce it into our economy, into our economic process. Now, you know, that says something about the United States, about the character of the United States. And this is exactly what these guys went after. So, you know, where am I? Okay. So he's writing this paper, and Adorno, he's studying with Schoenberg. They're part of this Frankfurt School, and he starts working with Walter Benjamin. So it's an Adorno and Benjamin, and together their project is to mechanize the aesthetic, they say. Now, it's kind of an interesting question. How would you take what Cody developed? How would you take the relationships, the harmony of, you know, the individual human being to the universe? How do you mechanize that? Or why would you want to? Why would you want to turn something that is inherently creative into something non-creative, essentially? So that he talks about, when he's talking about light music, he's talking about, I guess, banal music. And then the serious music he discusses is like the classical composers, like Bach, Beethoven, Schubert, and these guys. So he says, in order to, what we have to do, oh, let me just finish this quote here real fast. Okay. Because it's interesting the way that he thinks about humans. Says, so remember, we just had this idea of anybody who thinks Schubert is beautiful or Handel is beautiful, they're a guardian of culture among the butterfly collectors. Okay. So he says, what condemns him as an epicure is not perhaps new. The power of the street ballad, the catchy tune, and all the swarming forms of the banal has made itself felt since the beginning of the bourgeois era. Today, the power of the banal extends over the entire society. Its function has changed. This change of function affects all music, not only light music, in whom's realm it could be comfortable enough it could be comfortably enough be made light of as simply gradual. The diverse spheres of music must be brought together, light and serious music. Okay, so he said his first hypothesis is we have these two different forms of music. Because the problem is today is that people don't know how to listen to music, right? So this is how his first hypothesis is, okay, we've got to bring this light music and this serious music together. Now, I mean, one thing to be said is one of the ways that these guys argue this is to actually create an argument that it doesn't really exist. Well, for instance, that, you know, the population has a problem. So what we have to do, the way we're going to try to solve this problem is we've got these two options. Some people like serious music, some people like light music. Right? The serious music, though, it's bourgeois. And he gets into it a little bit more. But already there's no standard of truth to say what is right and what is wrong, what is the best. Right? It's kind of like the kids you meet on campus when they say it's capitalism and socialism. You know, if you're not a capitalist, you're a socialist. Right? When instead you can actually break, you know, those two systems, they don't really work as systems and such. It's not really it's not a truthful argument, because real history has been defined between the system of an empire and the system that the Americans set up, the American system. So the idea of imposing, you know, are you a socialist or a capitalist? It's arbitrary. There's no real significance to it, except to kind of trap people into arguing about that, you know, while reality, you know, while you've got Dick Cheney and these guys running and Kerry and these guys or running a coup. You could say the same thing about, you know, Republican or Democrat. Are you a Kerry or a Cheney man or a Kerry or Bush man? You know, so he says, first of all, okay, let me just finish this then. I keep getting off track. He says, cynical, so we've got these two spheres, right, light music and serious music. He says, cynical barbarism is no better than cultural dishonesty. What it accomplishes by disillusion on the higher level, it balances by the ideologies of primitivism and return to nature. So the reason we have to balance these two things is because naturally, the way the universe works is you have primitive nature, primitive man, and then you have just cultural dishonesty, which is the bourgeois. Right? And so, you know, we have to live in this world that balances things. So you have to balance the bourgeois dishonesty, the disillusionment, with the real innate primal, you know, character of man. And these guys were wackos. This guy Walter Benjamin had a theory about Genesis. When they talk about this stuff, the story of the Garden of Eden, he says that is the story of the original alienation. Because what you have in the Garden of Eden is Adam, you know, he's working the land, and he's eating the crop, he's eating the fruit, literally, of the sweat of his brow. He has a direct relationship to the object that he's producing. And when they leave, and when they start producing nation states, when they start producing different languages, when they start developing a human, you know, culture, he says that is the alienation, because you're stepping away, you're getting out of that direct relationship with what you sow from the ground. So, you know, that's their idea of development. They call it the bourgeois. He continues. I'm just trying to figure out how not to read whole pages of this stuff. So, he says, the illusion of a social preference for light music as against serious is based on that passivity of the masses, which makes the consumption of light music contradict the objective interest of those who consume it. The unity of the two spheres of music is thus that of an unresolved contradiction. They do not hang together in such a way that the lower, the light music, could ever serve as a sort of popular introduction to the higher, or that the higher could renew its lost collective strength by borrowing from the lower. The whole cannot be put together by adding the separated halves, but in both there appear, however distinctly, the changes of the whole. If the flight from the banal becomes definitive, if the marketability of the serious product shrinks to nothing, in consequence of its objective demands, then on the lower level, the effect of the standardization of successes means it is no longer possible to succeed in an old style, but only in imitation as such. Between incomprehensibility and inescapability, there is no third way. The situation has polarized itself into extremes which actually meet. If you didn't understand the rest of that, just keep paying attention because you'll get this part. There is no room between them for the individual. The latter's claims, the individual, wherever they still occur, are illusory, being copied from the standards. The liquidation of the individual is the real signature of the new musical situation. Okay. So that's what he's saying. That's where we're at in society. He says this is from 1938. And so he says, well, what do we have to do? Music will become a fetish. We have to fetishize music. Right? And what he means by fetishism is that essentially you're taking what Cody went through is an actual relationship that music has, right? For human beings to communicate ideas. To fetishize something, you know, if people have like foot fetishes or something like, it's not based on any reality. It's not based on the outside universe. It's not based on your relationship to anything real. It's completely, how would you call it? It's dissociated, right? So he says the music world is one of fetishes, or it will become one of fetishes. So essentially, there's a couple good ones here. He talks about singing voices. How do you fetishize a singing voice? He says, at its most passionate, musical fetishism takes possession of the public valuation of singing voices. Their sensuous magic is traditional, as is the close relation between success and the person endowed with the material. He says, today, the material as such, destitute of any function, is celebrated. One need not even ask about the capacity for musical performance. Even mechanical control of the instrument is no longer really expected. To legitimate the fame of its owner, a voice need only be especially voluminous or especially high. Right? So instead of the voice actually being used as a function to communicate an intention, you know, he's saying all you do is you objectify the voice. You just say, how high can, you know, arbitrarily, how high can it go? Arbitrarily, how loud can you make it? You know, which is exactly the opposite. It's exactly the opposite way that you actually communicate an idea. You know, if any of you have seen William Warfield, you know, he would come out here at 80 years old and you would, you know, his physical voice would be deteriorating because he was 80 years old. But the idea that he was able to express with his voice came through regardless. It was totally powerful. And what these guys are saying is you take that out of it. You separate the mind and the body essentially and the voice. So he goes on. If the moments of sensual pleasure in the idea, the voice, the instrument, are made into fetishes and torn away from any functions which could give them meaning, they meet a response equally isolated, equally far from the meaning of the whole, and equally determined by success in the blind and irrational emotions which form the relationship to music into which those with no relationship enter. And he says, you know, these are the relationships between the hit songs and the consumers of the hit songs. That their only relation is that of an alien, completely alien. And he says, were they, you know, that they have problems reacting. He says, were they to react at all, it no longer makes any difference whether it is to Beethoven's Seventh Symphony or to a bikini. It doesn't matter. Because you're not actually trying to comprehend the idea. You don't see a Beethoven piece as an idea. You don't see a piece of music as you know, like what we were going through, what Cody was going through. Essentially, it's just a sensual... You turn any kind of response to an idea into just a reaction, a sensual reaction. So people don't even know how they react, you know. But if you're seeing a I don't know how if you should think about it, I guess how you react when you see a bikini, you know, and then actually think about a Beethoven piece. Some people, okay. So. And the way you go about fetishizing music is, of course, in the critical nature, he's saying that society today doesn't appreciate good art. People today, the bourgeois, they don't go to concerts, right, to appreciate the music. They don't get excited about listening to the music. Because he's a socialist and he's kind of hung up on some of this stuff. But he says people go to the concerts because what they really appreciate is the price of the ticket, is the money they spent on the ticket. It's the social status of the concert, of the music, that they really enjoy, that really gives them their pleasure. So, but you could say that with anything. I mean, he talks about it in terms of money, but, you know, really, as long as you're alienating the audience from the idea of the piece, from actually trying to understand the piece, you could have them enraptured about anything, like the seat that they're sitting in. I mean, in this case, it's money, right? Because only a certain number of people can afford those tickets. Like today, with cars or something like that. You know, really inherently, there's nothing special about these cars, you know, fundamentally, that go for $60,000 or $70,000. You know, but the idea is, I'm going to get the new version because, frankly, only a limited amount of people can get that version. So I'm one of the special people that can afford it. Right? But there's no connection to the actual function of the automobile. Alright, so this is all the fetishization of music. And he develops this like exchange value a little bit. He says, the change in the function of music involves the basic conditions of the relation between art and society. The more inexorably the principle of exchange value destroys use values for human beings, use value being the actual function of the thing, like the car or the actually going to the concert to listen to the music. The principle of exchange value destroys use values for humans. The more deeply does exchange value disguise itself as the object of enjoyment. For instance, the appearance of exchange value in commodities has taken on a specific function. The woman who has money with which to buy is intoxicated by the act of buying. In American conventional speech, having a good time means being present at the enjoyment of others. Right? When all you're doing is just being there. You know, you're not actually doing anything. You're just there. You're in a situation where people are having fun. He says, the couple out driving who spend their time identifying every passing car and being happy if they recognize the trademark speeding by. The girl whose satisfaction consists solely on the fact that she and her boyfriend look good. You know, I mean, it's funny, but really think about your friends. Think about the way that you think. Because I don't think like, think about the way that our generation, you know, looks at things. I mean, this is from 1938. He says, okay. So that was the kind of general fetishization of music. The next part, he says, is the regressive listening. So you get people's, you know, attachment, their identity to an arbitrary thing, like commodities, like money, right? Like the social status of doing whatever you're doing. He says the regressive listening is kind of the counterpart to the fetish. And he the definition of it. He says, I mean, basically what you're doing is you're creating a childlike listener. He says, not only do the listening subjects lose, along with freedom of choice and responsibility, the capacity for conscious perception of music, which was from time immemorial confined to a narrow group, but they stubbornly reject the possibility of such perception. So not only do they not have the ability to understand music, but they stubbornly refuse that they would ever want to do that. They stubbornly, you know, refuse to admit that they're not free. They fluctuate between, and this is kind of gets to the method. They fluctuate between comprehensive forgetting and sudden dives into recognition. They listen atomistically and dissociate what they hear. But precisely in this dissociation, they develop certain capacities which accord less with the concepts of traditional aesthetics than with those of football and motoring. Right? Think about the idea of the reacting. You're reacting to something that could be a driving, you know, driving for the afternoon or football or Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. He says, they're not childlike, but they are childish. Their primitivism is not that of the underdeveloped, but that of the forcibly retarded. Oh. Whenever they have a chance, they display the pinched hatred of those who really sense the other, but exclude it in order to live in peace, and who, therefore, would like best to root out the nagging possibility. Does that remind you of people who don't want to deal? They don't want you to infect their bubble. So they're totally enraged at you. You know, don't come at me with economic collapse. Don't come at me with any problems. I'm trying to enjoy myself. You know, it's getting harder and harder and harder for me to enjoy myself. So I don't need you, you know, in my face. So he says, regressive too is the role which contemporary mass music plays in the psychological household of its victims. They are not merely turned away from the more important music, but they are confirmed in their neurotic stupidity, quite irrespective of how their musical capacities are related to the specific musical culture of earlier social phases. So, you know, essentially he's describing how people will choose to be banal. They'll choose a certain formatted, formal standardized light music. You know, so first he had to take a culture that had a certain, you know, I guess connection to a classical tradition. You know, it wasn't perfect. We had people like Dvorak. We had, you know, the Negro spirituals. There was a certain Brahms at that time. He had just died. And first you attach people's emotions to this exchange value, to this social. You change people's identity from being productive to, you know, to having a social status. And in that process, you actually destroy people's connection to ideas, to making a discovery. And then you're able, to give them whatever you want to, and you can manipulate them to want it. And that's what this regressive listener is. He's somebody who not only is not able to concentrate on an idea, but he's somebody who wants his slavery. And that, I mean, he says that in here. And he uses advertising. They say advertising can be used to the regressive listener to make them feel impotent until they buy the product. So one of the most important elements of regressive listening is deconcentration. He says deconcentration is the perceptual activity which prepares the way for the forgetting and sudden recognition of mass music. If the standardized products hopelessly like one another, except for conspicuous bits such as hit lines, do not permit concentrated listening without becoming unbearable to the listeners, the latter are in any case no longer capable of concentrated listening. They cannot stand the strain of concentrated listening and surrender themselves resignedly to what befalls them, with which they can come to terms only if they do not listen to it too closely. So they were pretty open about it. I mean, he talks about jazz music. You know, the usual commercial jazz can only carry out its function because it is not attended to except during conversation, and above all, as an accompaniment to dancing. So they're pretty open about this stuff. You know, they talk about the idea of a whistler. They say somebody who's on a subway or a train whistling a Brahms piece, whistling a, you know, da-da-da-da, something like that. They've already begun the process of devaluing the piece. Because you're, you know, and think about it, I mean, it's a really big problem with our generation, but you only remember the parts that really come out at you. You only remember the parts that are the really famous parts. And it's all the work in between, the actual process between those parts, the development of the piece. You don't whistle those things, you know. You don't walk around whistling that. So he continues. You know, he talks about making people atomized listeners, so they grab on to specific parts of a piece. You know, think about what they do in movies or commercial jingles. Right? You can walk around with a certain jingle in your head for years. I had a jingle in my head from a pull-ups commercial for like 6 years. That one. It's the one. It's like, wow, holy cow, I'm a big kid now. For some reason, it just stuck in my head, And it's just a total neurotic fetish, you know. But I mean, that's what these things are designed to do. He says at one point that regressive listeners, they behave like children, because they arrogantly demand what they're given. They don't demand what they want. They demand, you know, the music that they're given. And eventually for our sad regressive listener, a couple of things happen. eventually what happens is they'll want to rebel, because an important part of the regressive listening is just a total passivity, right? You're just turning on the radio. And that was an important element of this, too. Adorno worked along with Benjamin, or not with Benjamin, but he worked as part of the radio project that was run out of Princeton, which was you know how he talks about at the beginning the unification of the two spheres of music, the light music and the serious music? Well, he says the way you do that is through the totalitarianism of the radio, where you can both fetishize it. He'll go through it a little bit. You both fetishize it, and you destroy people's ability to actually concentrate on music as an idea. Because if you think about what before the radio, not that the radio is a bad thing, but before the radio or before recordings, you know, maybe once, if you were twice, if you were lucky, would you ever see a live performance of a symphony, of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, or of a major piece of work? You know, maybe you would go to church. And so you when you went to see these things, it was a huge deal. You know, and you didn't want to miss any of it. You wanted so you were there, you were active the whole time, actively participating in getting the idea. And part of what the work that they did with this radio project was to destroy that, to destroy the uniqueness of these pieces of music. So he says, eventually what happens to the regressive listener is, there's a couple, it changes their personality a little bit. First, they want to rebel because they recognize that they're being passive consumers. So they want to get out, they want to break out of that. They don't like being passive consumers. So they say, I want my own identity. I don't want the radio to control me. He says, so they attach themselves to what they think is like the vanguard or the antithesis of what they think is standard, right? To the independent labels, right? And he calls this specifically pseudo-activity. They activate themselves, but it's pseudo-activity because they're not addressed, they're not, you know, it's like what we were discussing before. They're not dealing with the real problem of the fact that, you know, that music, of the difference between classical music or bubblegum or whatever. What they're saying is that I grew up in a, this is an example, I grew up in a suburb, you know, suburb kids. They're the worst, you know. Suburb kids grow up, you know, with like MTV, with all these things, with a very standard routine format. And so by the time you're a teenager in the suburbs, it's like you either become the most extreme, like crackhead, you know, grunge, or you become, you know, into hip hop. You know, but what about a suburb culture would ever make somebody want to get into hip hop culture, want to walk around like that? You know, it seems like they're two totally extreme things, right? It seems like, yeah, I'm breaking out of the suburb culture. I'm going to go wild. You know, I'm going to do drugs. I'm not going to be like everybody else. You know, but it's pseudo activity. It's like the essence of pseudo activity because they don't actually get to the point where they say, well, wait a minute. Why is it that my parents lie? Why is it that, you know, our country is set up like this? Right. So he says that pseudo-activity is actually more enslaving than the passive consumer. Because at least the passive consumer knows they're just passive, you know, they're just kind of taking what they can get. The guy who's a pseudo-activator, whatever the hell, is somebody who actually creates his identity, you know, around his rebellion, around maintaining the status quo. So, you know, he says they become actually more enslaved because they actually assume the identity of the banal music, of the light music. Then you have number two. It says it's called the radio ham. Now, this man is the most fetishized of all. Because he doesn't care how he hears, the quality of his hearing. He doesn't care what he hears. But he says he immerses himself in the radio culture. And he says that this is the guy who's most similar in mentality to a jock, to a football player in a stadium. You know, he's more similar to the football player in a stadium than the fan is. Because, you know, he's going to memorize. He knows everything. You know, and his identity is in the fact that he is the best at performing in this certain system. Mind you, he doesn't actually make a creative... He doesn't get outside of the radio. He doesn't ever contribute anything new. What he does is he just takes all of the standard formats. Like, he talks about the jazz, you know, the jazz musician. Okay, he says, this is the listening expert who can identify every band and immerses himself in the history of jazz, as it were, holy writ. He is nearest to the sportsman, if not to the football player himself, then to the swaggering fellow who dominates the stands. He shines by a capacity for rough improvisations, even if he must practice the piano for hours in secret, in order to bring the refractory rhythms together, you know? So he'll do whatever he can to actually maintain the persona of jazz, even if he's got to go home and actually practice and you know, get all the different, you know, types of relationships of notes together to make it seem like he's improvising when he gets up on stage. He pictures himself as the individualist who whistles at the world. But what he whistles is its melody, and his tricks are less inventions of the moment than stored-up experiences from acquaintance with sought-after technical things. He lies to himself about the completeness of his subordination to the rule of the reified mechanism. Thus, the sovereign routine of the jazz amateur is nothing but the passive capacity for adaptation to models from which to avoid straying. He is the real jazz subject. His improvisations come from the pattern, and he navigates the pattern, cigarette in mouth, as nonchalantly as if he had invented it himself. Okay. Now, with all of these, you know, assumed things, you know, and I'm sure some people can identify with this, what ends up happening is the regressive listener turns into a complete masochistic rage ball. Masochism in hearing is not only defined by self-surrender and pseudo-pleasure through the identification with power. Underlying it is the knowledge that the security of shelter under the ruling conditions is a provisional one. And eventually, everything must collapse. So, even in self-surrender, one is not good in his own eyes. In his enjoyment, one feels that he is simultaneously betraying the possible and being betrayed by the existent. Right? Do you guys get that? No? You know, I mean, essentially, people recognize that what they're addicted to, you know, is format, is protocol, is standard. But since their emotions have been, since they're emotionally connected to the social dynamic, to being the jazz guy, to being cool, to being, you know, to money. Since they don't really have a sense of all of these things, but they know that they have this general distrust. So he says, they're self-surrendering to pseudo-pleasure through identification with power. Like, they think that they have power. That the music, the pieces of music, he says, actually have power over these people. And these people think that they have power from the music. But, you know... But, it's just like he said... you know, think about the idea of not trusting anybody, right? His enjoyment is stifled because he is simultaneously being betrayed by the existent, and he is simultaneously betraying the possible. Then he says, regressive listening is always ready to degenerate into rage. If one knows that he is basically marking time, the rage is directed primarily against everything which could disavow the modernity of being with it and up to date, of being cool, right? Because essentially, what is being cool? Where is the measurement of cool? Popularity? Okay. All right. But, like, you know, what Cody was going through is that the human voice, you can measure the quality of the human voice by its relationship to the universe, by the certain boundary conditions that order it. Where is the ordering process in being cool? It's arbitrary. I mean, think about cool people. I mean, really cool people are probably most of the neurotic people in the world, because they are always, what he says here is, they're always having to worry about somebody screwing up with their coolness, of making them not modern or not up to date. You know, think about social relations that we have in high school, you know. Now, instead of relating to people based on producing something, on producing, you know, an idea and working through something, you relate to people based on how cool they are and if you can get into their group or what group can you get into, you know. Okay. Oh, and then he brings up this interesting little idea here. He says, for the regressive listener, they would like to ridicule and destroy what yesterday they were intoxicated with, as if in retrospect to revenge themselves for the fact that ecstasy was not actually such. This effect has been given a name of its own and repeatedly been propagated in press and radio. But we should not think of the rhythmically simpler light music of the pre-jazz era and its relics as corny. Rather, the term applies to all those syncopated pieces which do not conform to the approved rhythmic formula of the present moment. So even you thought you, at least we came up with the idea of corniness, you know, of just something being just ridiculously absurd. Where does it come from? 1938, socialist revolutionary. You know, so this guy defined our generation's idea of cool. And what is it? Essentially, it's rage at the fact that what you got enjoyment out of yesterday, because what happened yesterday is not as cool as what's happening right now. It's not as up to date. That you're gonna you revenge yourself in some way by devaluing that ecstasy, saying, "Ugh, that's so corny," you know. Like the new kids on the block or something. Like when we were all in school, the new kids on the block were very cool. They were very with it, you know. And now, if I say the new kids, okay, see, see, okay. All right. So now, just think about this. I mean, think about what they're doing. What time is it? Okay. All right, I'm almost finished. The irony is that a lot of this stuff, if you think about it, if you think about, you know, this coolness question or corny or being up to date or with it, I mean, being up to date, this was written in 1938. So, you know, there's no relation to anything real. I mean, and essentially, what's happened is you get people, you know, with this pseudo-activity business. You know, you get all these different social phenomenons going on. Or, you know, look at the way that they teach history, right, where they say, oh, well, really, you know, the United States is founded on principles of racism and whatnot because of the way we treated the Native Americans, right? And I think I was talking to Sky about this today, and he gave me a really good idea, which is if you think about a dollhouse, a pink dollhouse, right, and just taking people and locking them up in this dollhouse, right, and so these people, they say, okay, well, I've got to learn everything about this dollhouse. I've got to learn about the paint. I've got to learn about the furniture, the spacing. I've got to learn about the windows, the architecture. I've got to know everything about it. So then I can be on the edge of it. Then I can get on the outside of it. Right? But reality is you're locked in a dollhouse. The dollhouse is not reality. The dollhouse is not, it's totally fetishized. It's disconnected from reality. Because the real question is, how do you develop a human identity? The real question is, well, how do you, it's enough to deal with the problems in actually developing the human voice, in developing the emotional capacity to make discoveries, right? You don't need, you know, that's the real universe. Those are the problems humans deal with. There are problems, right? To say that we have to go and deal with being cool and being locked in a pink dollhouse, and we have to figure all of that stuff out before, you know, it creates just an entirely separated domain. It gets people focused on something that's not really there. It's not reality. And that's what we're dealing with a lot of people. So people are just locked up in their, you know, just think about it. They're just locked up in these pink dollhouses, you know, running around in circles trying to come up with something all by themselves. You know, and it makes for a very unhappy people. It's kind of like the essence of unhappiness, which is an attack on the idea that actually founded this nation, which was the pursuit of happiness. That's written in the Declaration of Independence: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And this is an idea from Gottfried Leibniz. And I mean, really, because if you want to look at this, they weren't just attacking the human voice. They weren't just attacking or music for music's sake or art because, you know, Schoenberg really, really wanted his 12-tone system to be, you know, famous or something. What these guys were doing was attacking the idea of the United States. And they use music and they use, you know, probably because music, you know, has a huge, profound effect on people, you know, to change the identity of the population inside the United States and to actually make people want unhappiness. I mean, that's what they're saying, right? You find pleasure in displeasure. I mean, how much more ridiculous, how much more obvious could that be? You want to take people who have a certain idea and make them attach that idea to something that's the opposite of that idea. So I thought we should maybe refresh ourselves on what Leibniz says on happiness. He says happiness is an enduring state of contentment or pleasure. Thus, it is good to moderate or abandon some pleasures which can be harmful by causing pains or by preventing better and more enduring pleasures. Okay. Well, what is a pleasure? I mean, this is Leibniz's idea of pleasure, right? This is not just like a sensual pleasure. He says, pleasure is the knowledge or the feeling of perfection, not only in ourselves but in others, because then it excites those pleasures within ourselves. So there's a social process going on there. We can't all just be locked in these pink little houses. You know, the idea of happiness involves, you know, working with other human beings and perfecting them. Okay, well, what is his idea of perfection? He says there's two, you know, it's a knowledge. It's two different types of knowledge. One is, you know, the knowledge of facts. Like if you need directions, he says, if you need directions to get to somewhere, that those facts, they help you to do that. But the other one is the knowledge of reasons. And it's those reasons which actually perfect human beings. Because it's those reasons which get us outside of the sensual domain. He says, because it informs us of the universal and eternal truths which express the perfect being. And then I thought he had another one on it. But if you think about that, and think about, you know, the discussion about the human voice, that you have something, that human beings, you know, we have a naturally kind of interesting relationship to the universe. We have a voice. We have a sensual way to communicate ideas. You know, we don't just send little, like, telepathic messages to each other. And that our body is organized, right, by a reasoning power, by our mind, by something which, by the very thing which actually has the capacity to know the Creator. You know, and you have that relationship, you have that harmony in the human singing voice when it's developed the way that Cody went through. So, you know, it's an interesting idea that these people would specifically choose to attack and try to and dissociate and alienate people from their own relationship to the universe. You know, it's an attack on this idea of happiness. It's an attack on the United States. And, you know, the importance of the CCF document that we have is that, you know, if you related to any of these, you know, problems, neuroses, you know, coolness things, whatever, then you have to recognize that it's not a human problem. It's not honest to say that those are human problems, because those are problems that are created. They were created by Theodore Adorno, by these people. And the reason they created them was to destroy the citizenry of the United States, destroy the U.S., the country. So it's a political fight. And what we're doing is we're saying you can solve those problems if you're actually interested in solving those problems for yourself and for other people, because you won't attain happiness without perfecting other people. Then, you know, you should fight politically to win, essentially. So that's about it.